Early morning thunderstorms ignited wildfires in western Montana. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Reporter Edward O'Brien tells us about Governor Steve Bullock's energy policy. And in tonight's feature interview, Capitol reporter Dan Boyce gives us an inside look on the impacts of the Calgary flood. With this morning's rain came lightning and caused three fires in the southwestern DNRC area. The Southwestern Land Office of DNRC's Fire Prevention Coordinator and spokesperson for the Missoula Fire Protection Association, Cindy Super, says the small fires were in Florence, Grant Creek, and the Blackfoot areas.
So far, all of them are staying small. There are what we would say is less than a tenth of an acre, so, and are not having any trouble with the initial attack. We do have people at each of those fires, and so don't anticipate any problems, and we'll be working to put those out today.
By tomorrow, the Missoula County Fire Protection Association, or MCFPA, will move the fire danger from moderate to high. The MCFPA says it's important to make sure campfires are cool to the touch before leaving them because of continued hot, dry days and this week's temperature in the lower 90s. And even though Missoula County debris burning remains closed, they encourage people to make sure their spring burn piles are fully extinguished. Super says that this time of year, high fire danger is normal.
What we're looking at is the condition of the fuels over the course of the last week, and because it was pretty hot and dry, that started to dry things out a little bit, and so not entirely unusual to see bits of rain here and there, and that'll bring it down a little bit, but it only takes a couple of days for that moisture to either get drawn into the soil or evaporate back into the air. So what we're looking at in that case is these finer fuels, the grasses and small twigs and stuff, and that responds really quickly to heat and wind.
For more information, visit www.firerestrictions.us or www.mcfpa.org.
And in other news from around the state, Yellowstone National Park administrators say a tentative plan to relax gray wolf hunting and trapping rules in neighboring Montana appears aimed at substantially reducing the park's population of the predators. Wolves regularly cross from the safe haven of Yellowstone into Montana, where wildlife officials want to drive down pack numbers. Montana Wildlife Commissioners on Wednesday take final action on proposals to lengthen the wolf season, increasing the bag limit and set quotas around the park. Park administrators say some of the changes would make it too easy to target wolves that live primarily in Yellowstone. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Park spokesman Ron Affheim says the agency will recommend revisions to the proposal to address Yellowstone's concerns, but the wolf quota north of Yellowstone would exceed what the park wants.
Furloughs begin this week for civilian employees of the Department of Defense in Montana. The Great Falls Tribune reports about 800 people in Montana will be affected by the furloughs required to meet federal budget cuts. About 525 civilian personnel at Malmstrom Air Force Base and more than 200 with the Montana National Guard in Montana, plus some Army personnel, have been receiving furlough notices for the last week. Commissaries on military bases nationwide are closing on Mondays due to civilian furloughs. Malmstrom's commissary is already closed on Mondays, so it will also be closed on Tuesdays starting this week through the end of September. Most civilian personnel will be furloughed for 1 8-hour shift per week through September 30th. The Montana furloughs are expected to save the department $3.2 million.
Governor Steve Bullock today noted the difficulty of straddling the fine line between responsible energy development in Montana and maintaining a clean environment. Bullock's appearance at today's nonpartisan city club, Missoula Public Forum, drew a large crowd who came to listen to his thoughts on a variety of topics. One audience member asked him to specifically discuss his energy policy. Bullock says he believes Montana can be a part of what will help America become energy independent. He noted almost 30% of the nation's coal reserves are located right here in Montana.
You know, if I was emperor of the world, not just governor, I'd love to see all that coal being utilized in the U.S. There's some great technology things coming along. Department of Energy doing a sequestration project in the Kevin Dome in eastern Montana, where it's also revitalizing old oil wells that shows incredible promise. But by the same token, I mean, this is going to be a transition. Coal will be part of our foreseeable future. Montana has a lot of it, and it will be developed.
Bullock reiterated his conditional support for the Keystone XL pipeline.
For one thing, there is the proposed on-ramp in Baker, which would take 100,000 barrels of Western North Dakota, Eastern Montana oil a day. I think if once we actually do, once someone does, because the president said, well, you know, we need to take a look at this to see if it actually contributes more to greenhouse gas. When you look at actually how much transportation is already coming out of there and what the State Department had said, by and large, is that it wouldn't have significant adverse environmental consequences. I think that this can be a winner. We have 83 pipelines. I think it's 83 pipelines of various kinds crossing from Canada to the U.S. This one has been a significant issue in some respects, but I think long-term can provide a significant difference.
Bullock also discussed recreational stream access issues in Montana by expressing his hopes that disputes can eventually be depoliticized. He said stream access-related lawsuits consume tremendous amounts of time and resources.
So to figure out a way that it's not just private parties that have to carry the burden when a new obstacle occurs, and we are looking at different ways that you might be able to institutionalize that in government. One thing that I've revitalized is the Public Wildlife Private Lands Council. We haven't appointed yet, but at the end of the day, just as I say, education is a great equalizer. So is the opportunity to hunt and fish and enjoy Montana. We're looking at ways that you could actually more institutionalize when access gets broken or blocked. And also, though, we need to cool sort of the temperature and get private landowners and sportsmen and sportswomen sitting back around the table saying, long-term, how do we make sure that there is sufficient access going forward?
Bullock also listed some of what he described as legislative victories and setbacks from the 2013 session. Among the victories he listed including shorting up the state employee pension system without raising taxes and securing funding for education and several infrastructure projects around the state. He also mentioned some of the what he called the session's shortcomings.
I teamed up with Jim Peterson, a senator from Buffalo, and we had the TRACE Act, Transparency and Reporting and Accountability in Campaigns and Elections. It essentially said if you're going to spend money to influence our elections, you got to say where the money comes from. That ended up dying. We need to do more. I think that's important for the continuing vitality of our democracy and our representative government.
Another disappointment to Bullock, the failure of Medicaid expansion in Montana.
Access Health Montana, we called it. I mean, here we had an opportunity to create 5,000 jobs next year alone, to cover 70,000 more Montanans, to actually begin to reform the way that we provide health care. Montana, even though we had majorities voting in each legislature for it, through sort of procedural games and reassignment, Medicaid expansion or Access Health Montana didn't pass. It's really unfortunate because now your tax dollars are going to go to provide health care for the citizens of Arizona, Nevada, and other places. So that was a failure, or a disappointment, if you will.
About 130 people attended the City Club Missoula Forum today.
Officials with Northwestern Energy say they aren't abandoning the use of coal-fired power, even as the Obama administration seeks to set limits on greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. Northwestern CEO Bob Rowe tells Lee Newspapers of Montana that the company does plan to bring on more renewable power and continue programs that encourage energy conservation. But he says coal still generates about half of the power the company sells its 340,000 Montana electricity customers. About 15% of the company's power is renewable energy, most of that wind energy. Rowe says the company's planning assumes that carbon dioxide emitted by coal and gas-fired power plants eventually will face federal restrictions. On June 26, President Barack Obama announced he would seek to limit carbon dioxide emissions from power plants.
For anyone, a house fire can be financially unsettling, but for those who are already in a tough economic situation, it can be a crisis. And for some Missoula families, that's exactly what it has become. The Missoula Housing Authority has been doing what it can to help, but it can't much longer.
A phone to some knitting yarn and lots of rags and clothes and tons of clothes.
Missoula Housing Authority asset manager Carl Pare
has been dealing with a lot of things outside the usual scope of his job, including sorting through donations. The donations are for the Vantage Villa residents who lost their homes and most of their belongings in a fire about 3 weeks ago.
This is one of those, you know, wish they would have had renter's insurance situation, but none of them, you know, a lot of them don't have enough money to even have that.
The Vantage Villa apartments on East Broadway were built in 1980 and have housed low-income families ever since. The villa was the first public housing project in Missoula.
And those are where the tenants pay 30% of their adjusted gross income for rent, and then the housing authority receives a subsidy on a monthly basis from the government to be able to maintain those buildings and operate them.
Executive Director Lori Davidson says for the public housing units, the MHA essentially acts as a landlord. But especially in a time of crisis like this, the tenants look to the housing authority for a lot more.
We do become sort of put in this light by a lot of our residents as the everything, all in one. You know, they're expecting us to provide them with, you know, new furniture and clothing and beds and things like that, which we really is not within the scope of our business.
Private landlord may not feel an obligation to relocate the tenants or to find them new units. And we really felt that we had that obligation to do so.
A lot of the folks that were living there, they were there for 15, 17 years. I mean, unbelievable long amounts of time. And as a landlord, that's the other thing, too, that made the decision to want to help support these people throughout this process, is that they've been loyal to us as well.
And we've been putting them up temporarily in local hotels, but that's getting extremely expensive.
Even at a reduced rate of $60 a night, the Missoula Housing Authority can't afford to help those who haven't found new housing much longer. They've sent letters to the still unplaced residents telling them they'll be on their own in about a week.
And it literally would make the Housing Authority go belly up. And we serve so many more people in the community than just these 41 families.
The Housing Authority has 133 other public housing projects, and public housing is just part of what they do to provide and maintain affordable housing. The Housing Authority plans on rebuilding the Vantage Villa apartments and inviting the residents back, but that could take up to a year. Davidson expects to spend through all of the emergency funding by then. She worries there won't be funds for the next emergency, although they don't happen too often.
This is the first time I've ever been involved in my 17 years here at the Housing Authority with a major event like this.
Same goes for Paré, who says one of the biggest things he's taken away from the experience is the value of looking ahead.
Renter's insurance. You know, it's one of those things you'll probably never use, but obviously in this situation, they really wish they would have had it.
The Housing Authority is still looking to place 14 families and encourages anyone who knows of immediately available, especially one-bedroom units, to call the Missoula Housing Authority at 549-4113. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Ruth Eddy.
Park County officials say the body of a missing Livingston man has been found about a mile from where his car was found abandoned last month. Coroner Al Jenkins tells the Livingston Enterprise that 27-year-old Brad Spaulding committed suicide. Spaulding was reported missing to Livingston police on June 14th. His car was found at the George Lake Trailhead south of Livingston on June 17th. A search involving several agencies failed to turn up any sign of Spaulding. Sheriff Alan Lutz says a team of search and rescue dog handlers began looking in the area again on Friday afternoon after a tip from a hiker. Spaulding's body was located about 150 to 200 yards off the trail.
A 46-year-old Haver man is charged with hiding cameras at his house and taking photographs of his girlfriend's 16-year-old daughter. The Haver Daily News reports Gary L. Peterson pleaded not guilty on June 26 to felony sexual abuse of children and possessing and producing child pornography. Court records say police found sophisticated photography equipment in the house he shared with his girlfriend and her daughter. Charging documents say the case came to light when a former co-worker of Peterson's discovered nude images of the girl while looking for computer equipment. Human Resources Development Council Executive Director Karen Thomas said Peterson had been dismissed from his job at HRDC before the photos were found.
Calgary in Alberta, Canada, lies less than 200 miles from the Montana border. The city of a million people is recovering from devastating floods which ravaged the area in June. A two-week emergency declaration was lifted last Thursday, and the Calgary Herald newspaper estimate the costs to repair infrastructure are coming in at hundreds of millions of dollars. The city is still growing its grit, putting on the annual Calgary Stampede as planned. It continues through this Sunday. In tonight's feature interview, Capitol reporter Dan Boyce speaks with Calgary resident Katie Marshall about her experience with the floods. Marshall traveled to Helena recently to spend time with family. She says it all happened very quickly on June 20th.
We went to bed on the 19th, and by the time we woke up on the 20th, it was a state of emergency in Calgary. We had such severe flooding that in 2005, there was a huge flood and a lot of homes flooded then. This flood was four times greater than that flood. And the flood this year, 2013's flood, was just intense. Homes and streets and everything. It became Lake Calgary because all of our downtown core, and this is a city of a million people, all of our downtown core, which is huge and has huge sky rises, was evacuated. And what's interesting is I've lived in Calgary, even being from Montana and being in Montana a lot. Usually we spent our summers here, but I've been in Calgary for the majority of my life, for 43 years, and I've never once heard an emergency broadcast. I heard four within 2 days saying, this is a state of emergency. We are calling for these people to evacuate. And it was terrifying. It was so terrifying. And it was within hours. Like, we live very close to the Rocky Mountains, and Banff and Canmore is a little town that is beautiful. It's in the heart of the mountains. They have a creek called Cougar Creek, which is usually a dry bed creek. And it's there in case of flooding and runoff from the mountains. You know, we have huge mountains. So, of course, it's wintry up there, and there's snow runoff and melting. And it ended up that they called for rain. And that combination of massive amounts of snow that had not melted, plus the rain, caused flash flooding in Canmore. And this is a creek bed that flooded that has homes along each side of it. And those homes were completely, like, homes on there were wiped right out by the water. And I had no idea how strong water can be. I mean, you see the footage from Katrina and all of those in the U.S. That are evacuated and hurt by, you know, flash flooding. But really to experience it was very intense. So Canmore was in a state of evacuation. Then the next thing that happened was our Trans-Canada Highway from Calgary to Banff, right by Canmore, was washed out. And this is a major highway. It'd be like the interstate getting washed out. And as you know, there's still lots of traffic along there that brings goods to and from the cities. They were completely shut off. Calgary was shut off. Canmore was shut off to any kind of import-export. So all of that water that was in Canmore that came rushing down was sent to Calgary, was coming our way. And we knew about it, but then they also said, well, and they're calling for massive amounts of rain. So that mixed with all of this water coming from Canmore and the runoff from the mountains, plus all of that rain in Calgary, all of a sudden everything just swelled beyond belief. And that's where we had the Lake Calgary hitting us. It was insane. If you stood on top of one of those skyrise buildings and looked down, it was just water everywhere, completely underwater.
What was the experience personally for you and your family? What did you have to do?
Well, for us, it was very, very heart-wrenching. We didn't lose our home. We didn't struggle with anything in that sense. What we struggled with is we're a small business. My husband and I own a pharmacy. And not only with that pharmacy, we have what we call a prescription center that we fill prescriptions for hospice patients. My husband has a expertise in hospice care. And because of the floods, all of our electricity, water, all those things were cut off. And it was for safety. I mean, in the basement, thankfully the electricity was cut off because we had about 4.5 feet of water in our basement, in our pharmacy. That, coupled with the fact that we had no electricity, was very, very difficult because we have an automated machine that packages drugs that are needed, like Dilaudid and all of the pharmaceuticals that are needed to help in pain and suffering when someone is passing. And my husband was not able to do his job. And it impacts us hugely because without the electricity, we couldn't run our computers, our packaging machine. And yet there were still prescriptions coming in and people needing their drugs in order to survive or in order to die with dignity. And my husband felt so helpless.
She says water was flowing over every bridge in town, further impacting delivery of supplies. The Calgary Herald reports the federal and provincial governments of Canada are expected to pick up the tab for the damage, more than $250 million, not counting overtime costs and non-priority infrastructure. Marshall agrees a large amount of money is needed.
Billions and billions of dollars, and they're talking about 10 years worth of rebuilding and small businesses that are going to go out of business because they don't have the income coming in and they can't afford to go and fix the buildings themselves and rent the equipment to do the work.
You've spent, like you say, a great deal of time in the U.S. throughout your life, and specifically in Montana. We are so close to Calgary. It's such a close city, and it's mm-hmm. such a major city, but I think that so many people in the United States maybe don't think about the issues in Canada, certainly with the same kind of commitment that they may think about issues in the United States. Why don't you talk about how you've perceived that and what your perception has been of how Montanans are receiving this news and thinking about it?
Well, I feel that, to use this as an example, there was a man behind my son and I in Target just the other day, and the woman that was helping me at the cash, she said, "Oh, you must not be from here because this isn't a debit card that I recognize." And I said, "Oh, no, we're from Calgary." And the man behind us said, he quickly jumped in and said, "Oh, I saw the devastation. I have never seen flooding like that ever." And I thought, you know, that's wonderful to be recognized and recognize that your neighbor to the north, you know, we share so many similarities. We're pioneer spirit, and Alberta is very, very similar to Montana in our type of people. We're good people, we're kind, and we care about our neighbors. You know, I just would hope that they would step in and realize that, you know, there are ways you can help. I mean, we've got the Red Cross in Canada, and they're needing donations, food for food banks, you know, all the same things that you need down here when there's devastation. We have that up there, and we can always use support from our neighbors to the south. Another great way is just remembering that we're a wonderful place. Just like we come to your state, we would love for you to come to our province. Calgary Stampede is a huge revenue builder. And believe it or not, if you can believe it, the Calgary Stampede was under 6 feet of water 2 weeks ago. And they're going to be having a parade and a rodeo and chuck wagon races and all the things that we're carrying on. And, you know, that speaks volumes to what kind of people Albertans are. We're a strong community. The Calgary Stampede's quote this year is, "Come hell or high water, we're having this stampede." And, you know, I think that speaks to the spirit of Montanans as well. and the people of the Northwest. I feel that we're all very strong, and not a lot of us gets us down. You think of the winters we live through. Goodness gracious. And we're all still here.
Well, I've been speaking with Katie Marshall, who lives in Calgary, Canada. Thank you so much for speaking with us about the flooding and the continuing issues that people are facing up there.
Thank you.
You can find a link to the Canadian Red Cross site for Calgary flood relief by visiting the story on our website, mtpr.org.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight expect mostly clear skies with thunderstorms. For central and southwest Montana, tonight there is a severe thunderstorm watch until 7 p.m. this evening. Tomorrow, across our listening area, expect sunny skies with highs in the 80s. And now for the editorial comments of Bruce Barling.
Never underestimate the ability of fire-breathing propaganda to tie good natural resource policy in knots, even when the misinformation operates against the very interests it purports to defend. Good policy is exactly what the proposed water compact between the state of Montana and Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes represents. However, thanks to extremist opponents and some otherwise reasonable non-tribal irrigators scared by fear-mongering, the compact, years in the works, was high-centered at the last Montana legislature, which is a necessary stop for its ratification. The compact aims to settle forever the legitimate water rights afforded by the 1855 Treaty of Hellgate, in which the Salish, Pend'oreille, and Kootenai peoples ceded 20 million acres of Aboriginal homeland to the United States in exchange for a 1.3 million acre Flathead Indian reservation and continuance of certain rights, such as for fishing, in all the accustomed places on and off the reservation. Courts have ruled that rights to fish mean little if streams don't have water. Therefore, the tribes have legitimate claims, though not quantified until now, to keep water in streams. The compact emerged from years of transparent discussions among the state, tribes, and federal government. It produced precedent-setting accommodation. The commission the Montana legislature tasked with negotiating tribal water rights represented the state. The public was afforded opportunity to review and comment on the proposed compact in dozens of meetings. The compact achieves a mutual objective: protect all valid existing uses of water while settling forever the substantial claims of the tribes. In accomplishing this, the tribes gave up significant claims for water on and off the reservation. But you never know that, based on the fear-mongering of various conspiracy theorists, many who publicly deny the legitimacy of Indian reservations and treaties, as well as the Western Montana Water Users Association, a shadowy new group with few identifiable spokespeople and a penchant for not revealing who runs and funds it. Some Flathead area legislators have also helped whip up bad blood around the compact. Their puzzling and paranoid opposition leaves you wondering whether they read the compact or have a clue about the benefits the settlement affords all Montanans. Opponents such as Kalispell Senator Verdell Jackson say the compact gives the tribes control over all water in western Montana. Nonsense. Actually, the compact requires the tribes to relinquish most of their rights off-reservation, except for a few existing state-owned in-stream rights they will co-manage, as well as several main river claims that will always be junior in priority to the great majority of existing non-tribal rights, including those for irrigation and hydroelectric production. The accord further requires the tribes to accommodate all existing legitimate uses of water in the Flathead Indian Irrigation Project, the center of the anti-compact insurgency. Moreover, new in-stream flow rights the tribes will receive for maintaining fisheries on irrigation project lands are conditioned on investments first occurring to improve irrigation infrastructure. That's why legislative and congressional ratification of the compact could free up more than $40 million of state money and much more in federal dollars to improve irrigation systems that benefit non-tribal irrigators, including compact critics. Still, opponents insist the agreement hides phantoms. They charge it as negotiated in secret, which is untrue. All negotiations were open to the public. They claim the tribes will dictate how all water is used on the reservation. Also untrue. The compact establishes a reservation water management entity comprised equally of tribal and non-tribal members. Some opponents indignantly charge that tribal rights created in treaties aren't legitimate, rejecting legal precedent as well as treaty language in the very U.S. Constitution they say the compact violates. Finally, they think they can negotiate a better deal. but that won't happen. The tribes have little incentive to negotiate with unreasonable people. They can instead opt to go to court and ask for more than they would get in the compact, forcing existing water users to hire lawyers in an expensive skirmish that could last decades. Condemning the compact ignores its significant benefits. It could provide certainty for future water development to nearly half of Montana. Currently, legal decrees for all water rights in western Montana are conditional, pending final settlement of tribal rights. Without a compact, future economic development on the Flathead Indian Reservation will be uncertain. Investment in reservation irrigation systems will go unfunded, and key fisheries left imperiled. Most crucially, however, a harmonious relationship between the tribes and their non-tribal neighbors will needlessly suffer. This is Bruce Farling of Montana Trout Unlimited. Contact us at www.montanatu.org.
Bruce Farling is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetic.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.